of the Prophet of God. It is a great honor for me to fight alongside you and to achieve martyrdom alongside you. What greater prosperity is there that your grandfather will vouch for us on the Day of Judgment? Burayr ibn Khudayr al-Hamdani is also thought to have told Imam Hussein, when the army of Yazid the tyrant cut off the water from the river Euphrates to the Imam and his caravan, he's thought to have told Imam Hussein, "O Hussein, please let me speak to the army of the enemy." Imam Hussein agreed. Burayr ibn Khudayr al-Hamdani went forth and spoke to the army of Yazid. He said, "O people, Prophet Muhammad is the true messenger of God, and he brought us glad tidings. How dare you to cut off the water to his children and his Ahlul Bayt, his household? Is this your remuneration for the Ahlul Bayt?" As Burayr said those words, Imam Hussein looked at him and said, "It is useless to talk to the army of the tyrant Yazid." Imam told him to return to the camp. Burayr ibn Khudayr al-Hamdani fought valiantly on the day of Ashura, and single-handedly he managed to kill tens of the army of Umar ibn Sa'd. He was martyred in the end by a lance which pierced his body from behind. After Burayr was martyred by one of the hordes of Yazid, Ka'b bin Jabir bin Amr al-Azdi, from behind with a lance, his sister told him after the events of Karbala, "You have killed the son of the Prophet of God and Burayr, the master reciter of the Holy Quran. I swear to God that I will never again speak to you." These were the last words of the sister of Ka'b bin Jabir bin Amr al-Azdi, who martyred Burayr. Well, dear listeners, we have come to the second and final program in our series. Take care and God bless.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Votes in the House of Lords, the migration bill is set to become law in the United Kingdom, enabling the Home Office to detain and remove anyone entering the country to seek asylum. They could also be transported to Rwanda or a third country under the plan. The UK struck an initial £140 million agreement with the East African country this year, but the plan has been stuck in the courts. Former British Prime Minister Theresa May has slammed what critics call the Illegal Migration Bill, or IMB, saying it will consign more people to slavery.
It will enable more slave drivers to operate and make money out of human misery. It will consign more people to slavery.
The United Nations has also lambasted the new legislation and warned that it's against international law.
The bill is at variance with the country's obligations under international human rights and refugee law, and will have profound consequences for people in need of international protection.
The UN also raised concerns about other countries following suit. UN refugee and human rights experts believe the IMB will exacerbate the already vulnerable situation of refugees across the UK. The No Accommodation Network, which represents a network of over 140 organisations and charities across the UK, called the passing of the bill shameful.
Whilst not unexpected, the passing of the Illegal Migration Bill marks a profoundly shameful and damaging moment for refugee protection and human rights in the UK.
Just hours after the UK passed the controversial bill, a so-called accommodation barge arrived in Portland Port, Dorset. It's due to house 500 asylum seekers, twice the number of people that it was designed for, raising doubts about its safety. It has drawn strong condemnation from different groups and organisations worldwide, with many describing it as a floating prison. Delivering a speech in Westminster, Shadow Home Secretary Yvette Cooper called the new IMB law a con and the use of barges as a sign of the Conservatives' total failure to clear the asylum backlog. A recent poll by YouGov reveals Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's rapidly falling favourability rating, which has sunk to its lowest level to date. In spite of protests and concerns over the anti-refugee plan, the government is adamant that it's the right move. According to official figures, more than 45,000 people were detected arriving by small boats in 2022, 60% higher than in 2021. Now, with the new bill, British authorities have the green light to indiscriminately remove asylum seekers, regardless of whether they are at a risk of persecution, have suffered human rights violations, or are survivors of human trafficking.
The people of Pakistan have held countrywide protests to voice their anger at the recent act of desecration of the Quran in Sweden. In less than a month, an Iraqi refugee in Stockholm committed the sacrilegious act twice while protected by Swedish police. The protesters called on the Islamic world to cut ties with Sweden and to expel its ambassadors from their respective countries.
Muslim nations should check out a comprehensive line of action to end such sacrilegious acts. We will continue our fight for the sanctity of our holy book.
In Europe, where you cannot talk about the Holocaust, burning the Quran is freedom of expression. This is the double standard of Europe. Such hate acts should be stopped.
Meanwhile, religio-political groups in Pakistan also demanded cutting off all diplomatic relations with Sweden, while urging the United Nations to legislate against the desecration of holy books, including the Quran.
Quran was desecrated from the second time in Sweden with the permission of the government. What freedom of expression is this? Global colonialist forces are behind this conspiracy, and the anti-Islam actors of Europe are involved in this insult.
While denouncing the incident, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif pledged to launch a campaign to end the blasphemy of holy books in the Nordic state. He said that his government would help create a common strategy to eliminate Islamophobia with the help of Organization of Islamic Cooperation.
Muslims around the world have been outraged by the repeated desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden in recent months. They are all in unison that these incidents are blatant provocation, attempting to inflame sentiments and undermine Islam as a religion. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Thousands of people marched and rallied in Seoul Saturday to mark the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War Armistice. They demand a peace treaty with North Korea and view critically the strong ties with the U.S. developing under South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol.
The United States is intervening in our political, diplomatic, military, and economy to maintain and strengthen its hegemony. As a result, the sovereignty of South Korea is being trampled and the national interest is being abandoned.
Previous South Korean President Moon Jae-in had engaged with North Korea and sought to replace the armistice with a peace treaty, but that failed to materialize with the U.S. refusal to respond to Pyongyang's freezing of its nuclear and missile testing.
Relations between North Korea and South Korea and the international community have deteriorated under President Yoon, who's initiated large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises. The U.S. has also deployed so-called strategic assets to South Korea, weapons capable of delivering a nuclear strike against North Korea, further raising tensions here.
South Koreans here have also been sensitive about the developing trilateral alliance with the U.S. and Japan.
Alliances involve solidarity and equal relationships, not subordination. President Yoon's administration has been increasingly influenced by Japan as well as the United States. The strengthening of the military alliance is very dangerous.
The official armistice anniversary is July 27th. Through this week, various events, including in Washington, D.C., will address replacing the armistice with a peace treaty and seeking better ties with Pyongyang. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After a call by Hezbollah chief Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, Lebanese worshippers took to the streets after noon prayers on Friday to protest the desecration of the Holy Quran.
I demand for the government of the Lebanon to expel the embassy of Sweden embassy for our dignity and prosperity.
Our protest is to defend and secure our Holy Quran and all the holies, starting from hijab, prayers and adhan, and all the holy sites, including the cause and the only cause of all Arab and Muslims, which are the Quds, etc., and the Quran.
We want to defend our Quran, and we don't want anyone to violate our holy book.
In a speech on Thursday, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, denounced the Swedish government for allowing such sacrilegious acts to take place on its territory and stressed that all Arab and Muslim states need to follow in the footsteps of Iraq and expel the Swedish ambassadors.
If all the Arab and Muslim countries withdrew their ambassadors from Sweden and asked the Swedish ambassadors in our countries to leave, then what would happen to Sweden and its government and its interests? Boycotting products is a good step, but it's not enough to teach them a lesson. When they see that their interests are at stake, and the Arab and Muslim countries are not too weak to take this step, then they would be forced to resolve this issue.
Nasrallah also called on the Lebanese government to adopt a firm stance against Sweden and asked the worshippers and mourners attending Muharram processions to commemorate the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein to always carry a copy of the Quran to show the world that they are ready to sacrifice their lives for the sake of protecting the holy book.
Today we have gathered to fulfill the call by His Eminence, the Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, who is the great-grandson of Prophet Muhammad, to whom God sent the Quran. We tell Sweden and the entire world that our Quran is Al-Quds. It is our dignity. And we will defend the Quran with all our power until they learn to respect it.
It is our duty to preserve God's religion and the messages He has sent us. To denounce the violation of the Quran, we came here today to say that this is our constitution. And we call on everyone, be they Christian, Druze, Sunni, Shiite, no matter what their sect or their Arab or Muslim nationality, to stand with us.
Several Muslim countries have already summoned Sweden's ambassadors or its charge d'affaires to protest the second incident of state-authorized desecration of the Holy Quran in the Swedish capital.
Lebanese protesters have stressed that the Holy Quran is not only a divine book which introduces Islamic teachings, it is also a book which represents humane values for all mankind. People here today say they are steadfast in defending the Holy Quran against any sacrilegious act. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Afghan female school graduates are shedding tears of dismay after their exclusion by the Taliban rulers from the university entrance exam, also known as Concours. they have been studying hard for the national test in order to pursue higher education. But all that has been in vain, as the Taliban have announced that only male students can sit for the exam this year.
I wanted to pursue my higher education and become a leader and serve my people. But now they say that girls cannot take the university entrance exam. This is unfair and unjust. I am so sad and feel like my life is over.
I wanted to enroll in medical university and become a professional doctor and help my country prosper. But unfortunately, the Taliban shut the doors on our dreams and future and denied us our rights.
In a new report, UN human rights experts say the Taliban authorities have increased restrictions on women and girls in Afghanistan in recent months. The UN has urged the Taliban to respect and protect the rights of all Afghans, especially women and girls, and to ensure their access to education, healthcare, and other essential services.
With all these restrictions on women in place, Afghanistan's future is looking increasingly bleak. Girls and women are losing hope as they are being excluded from all political, social, and educational spheres.
The Taliban have not given any clear indication of when or if girls will be able to resume their studies at high schools or universities. They say they are upholding women's rights in accordance with their interpretation of Sharia law and Afghan culture. No other Muslim country in the world imposes such restrictions on women's education. The fate of Afghan girls remains uncertain as they are being barred from most educational settings. For many of them, education not only is a source of knowledge, but also a source of hope and empowerment. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iranians from all walks of life once again out on the streets, chanting slogans and using the strongest terms to express their anger.
Protesters rallied in the Iranian capital, Tehran, after the Friday prayers, along with a number of other major cities across the country, to condemn the desecration of the Holy Quran.
The protesters also called on the foreign ministry to cut ties with Sweden. This is the second time in less than a month that an Iraqi refugee in Stockholm has committed the sacrilegious act with protection from Swedish police.
No one should allow themselves to insult our religious beliefs. This is absolutely unacceptable.
We just had to take part in this rally to get our voices heard.
The Swedish government has allowed this to happen, and we are here to express our anger.
We are here for our holy book, for our religion.
Later in the day, protesters once again gathered outside the Swedish embassy in Tehran, demanding the ambassador to leave the country.
It's the second time this is happening, so we should definitely show a stronger reaction.
Iranians are very well aware of the consequences of such blasphemous acts. That is why you see so many of us here.
We will not stop until the Swedish ambassador leaves our country.
This is exactly what we want our officials to do. The foreign ministry has to expel the ambassador, and we will continue these rallies until he leaves.
The Iranian foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to Tehran on Thursday, but the protesters are now calling for the expulsion of the ambassador. They are planning another rally in front of the foreign ministry in the coming days, demanding Iran to cut ties with Sweden. Gizem Shahmadi, Tehran.
Iranian Minister of Justice Amin Hossein Rahimi arrived in Damascus and met with his Syrian counterpart Ahmad al-Sayed. The two officials underlined the importance of uniting efforts legally and judicially to face unjust lawsuits filed in international entities by the United States and its Western allies against member countries of the Resistance Alliance, as well as working together to lift unjust sanctions on both countries. An initial agreement has been reached to form a joint legal committee for this purpose.
We will be signing a memorandum of understanding on exchanging expertise and organizing workshops. Western countries claim they respect international law while they are the ones who violate it the most. This is also the situation in northeast Syria. They loot Syria's oil, wheat, and cotton. Those are crimes committed against international law and UN Charter. There should be a legal deterrent. International law should be implemented.
The Iranian official also met with Syria's foreign minister, Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed ways to improve the historic relations between the two countries in service of both peoples. Rahimi said political and military relations between the two countries reached their highest levels during the war on Syria, reiterating the need to bolster economic and judicial partnerships.
The main focus of my visit is proposing to form a joint legal committee between Syria and Iran and other member countries of the Resistance Alliance to create a defense line against lawsuits filed against us by the enemies, and also to legally work to force the hegemonic regimes to compensate for the losses they inflicted on Syria, especially on its infrastructure. We should demand that in international entities.
Rahimi also visited Syria's People's Assembly, where he met with its speaker, Hamoudeh Sabbagh. The top Iranian official said his country will continue assisting the Syrian people, mainly in reconstructing what war had destroyed. Syrian and Iranian officials are keen on continuously exchanging visits in a show of serious willingness to further boost bilateral cooperation in all fields. This visit aims to develop judicial collaboration to match the political strategic ties between the two states. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Rush hour, Washington, D.C. Protesters assemble for demonstrations at a busy intersection.
We want 48!
A second day of demonstrations, timed to coincide with the second day of Israeli President Isaac Herzog's U.S. visit, included a joint address to Congress. His reaffirmation of a binding relationship between the U.S. and Israel was not kindly received by everyone.
It's a moral imperative. As an American citizen, where $3.8 billion of our tax money is going to fund apartheid and racism, death and imprisonment for people, is something I, as an American citizen, need to speak out against.
Herzog characterized a true friendship between the allies, his relationship with the U.S. troubling to those marked upon continued human rights abuses of Palestinians.
Our people in the homeland and outside the homeland continue to suffer from being bombed, whether it's in the Gaza Strip, or raids in the West Bank, for example, like what's happened in Jenin, or even in 48 Palestine, with what's happening, for example, in certain poor Palestinian cities.
Protesters have been standing out here for hours, temporarily shutting down this busy D.C. intersection. Passersby occasionally honk their horns to show support for the demonstrators. These protesters are worried about several issues, including more Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, and a potential judicial overhaul headed by Benjamin Netanyahu's regime that could give political allies control over the appointment of judges.
Judaism is a religion of 3,000 years to be subservient to God, and Zionism is a takeover. It's a transformation to nationalism, a base political, selfish, flawed nationalist movement.
What do we want?
Justice!
What do we want it?
Now!
If we don't get it!
Shut it down!
Observers have long accused Israel of violating human rights in the occupied West Bank. A 2021 report by Human Rights Watch said Israel's policies amount to apartheid and persecution. Colin Campbell, Washington.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In the United States, frustrated airline travelers are contending with a summer season of flight disruptions. This has been a major event in recent weeks. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. America's national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Surging summer delays and a record number of travelers have made the habitually horrible peak airline travel season feel even worse. While flight cancellations are down by about 14% this summer compared to last summer, according to flight tracking website FlightAware, delays are up and so are frustrations for travelers. "I got cancelled," one flyer told CBS News of their flight. "We don't know why, and they aren't going to fly us until 2 days from now." This week, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a bipartisan bill that seeks to address airlines' obligations to their customers at a time of growing disruption and dysfunction in the travel industry. "We understand that airlines don't control the weather, but they still need to meet certain basic standards of taking care of their customers," Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg told the Reuters news agency. Pete Buttigieg is pursuing new rules that would require companies to compensate passengers for delays or cancellations that are the fault of the airline. "One thing we've found is that even threats of regulation can motivate airlines to do the right thing," Transportation Secretary Buttigieg said. However, the airline says the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, is also to blame, pointing to a shortage of staff and shortage of air traffic controllers. The Federal Aviation Administration contends that severe weather and flight volume were the biggest drivers in flight delays in 2023. The agency contends that it is working to hire 1,800 more air traffic controllers over the next 12 months. It says it is also launching new online videos to explain to passengers in real time what is happening in the skies over the United States. But flight disruptions have not been the only challenge for travelers in the U.S. "We went directly through the State Department online, submitted our prior passports, which were only expired like a year," passport applicant Pam Rogers said. "A massive backlog of passport applications has potential international passengers waiting for up to 13 weeks for documents, which is causing missed trips, non-refundable charges, and a flood of constituents asking members of Congress for help. There's only a few times in your life when you actually need your government, and this is one of those moments," Pam Rogers said. The national broadcaster CNBC has also covered the same story and tells us more. Flight disruptions have mounted over the last few weeks as severe storms and staffing issues have kicked off a rocky summer season. More than 7,700 flights, U.S. flights, were delayed and nearly 2,200 were cancelled, according to FlightAware data. As thunderstorms that derailed thousands of trips over the weekend lingered in airspace that is heavily congested on a clear weather day. That's on top of more than 8,800 U.S. delays and close to 2,250 cancellations. The Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, paused flights banned for New York's LaGuardia Airport, John F. Kennedy International Airport, and Newark Liberty International Airport in New Jersey. Delays were averaging 3 hours or longer at those airports. The Federal Aviation Administration said that the thunderstorms were blocking arrival and departure routes in that area. The disruptions came ahead of the busy holiday season, holiday travel period when millions of Americans are expected to fly. The Transportation Secretary, Pete Buttigieg, said it could screen more travelers than before. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said he's pursuing new rules that would require companies to compensate passengers for delays or cancellations that are the fault of the airline.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Hundreds of years of slavery and creating the United States with their free labor has never earned black Americans equal footing in that society. Millions of Africans were kidnapped from their homeland, chained to each other at the bottom of ships, and transported thousands of miles away in harsh conditions to reach the ultimate hell of living as slaves and horrible conditions. They were human beings who became commodities to be bought and sold and treated inhumanely by their so-called owners, with many literally being worked to death and others being beaten to death. Their children were born into slavery with no way out, and this lasted for generations. Now, a new Florida ruling dealing with the state's educational curriculum says teachers can no longer teach that slavery was all bad, but that black Americans learned life skills and benefited from it. Saying this is even mind-boggling, but we'll try to dissect it all and what this even means on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Mr. Gerald Horn, Professor of African American Studies, University of Houston, out of Houston, Texas. And Mr. Joseph Richardson, Professor of African American Studies, University of Maryland, Laurel, Maryland. Thank you both for being with me. I'd like to start this off in Houston. Mr. Horn, presidential candidate in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis, has supported this change and says it is important because previous lessons on slavery presented one side of the story. Also mentioned in this curriculum change is that both sides committed violence during slave revolts when blacks were trying to free themselves from their oppressors. Your overall thoughts on this?
Well, it's obviously ludicrous. It's obviously ridiculous. It's a failing attempt by a prospective nominee for president, speaking of Governor DeSantis of Florida, who was losing spectacularly this race to the former president, Mr. Trump, and is seeking to revive his candidacy. I'm afraid to say, however, that this failing attempt might strike a chord with a certain segment of the Republican Party electorate, a certain segment of the Euro-American vote, because they feel that the story of slavery contradicts the uplifting narrative they would prefer to tell. That narrative suggests that the creation of the United States in the 18th century was this great leap forward for humanity, that the founders of the United States did everything except walk on water, and the idea of enslavement, not to mention the idea of liquidation and genocide against the indigenous population, the Native Americans, conflicts with that uplifting narrative. And the only way they can reconcile the uplifting narrative is to do violence to history, is to cover up the odious history of the United States, which was grounded and based upon enslavement of Africans and genocide against Native Americans.
Well, Joseph, the U.S. was built on the backs of Africans with no compensation, of the results of which are still being felt on both sides today. The African-American community is still reeling from economic inequity, and multinational companies and many white Americans are still benefiting from this inequity, which was established during slavery. Your assessment of this?
Well, clearly we know that, first of all, it's just such an absurd statement and comment, and we realize in states like Florida, with the repeal of teaching critical race theory in classrooms, that this is just another extension of it. But we know empirically, factually, that enslaved Africans were the most valued commodity in the United States. Far more valued than our railroad system at the time, far more valued than any other commodity in this country. And so for enslaved Africans to be considered, who actually brought their skills to the Americas as enslaved Africans, whether they were blacksmiths or farmers, all of these skills were skills that enslaved Africans had before they even arrived in the Americas as enslaved people. So to consider that we have benefited in some way from slavery is probably just the most absurd comment that any presidential candidate or American who's educated could possibly make. And further, you've mentioned that just in terms of the economics that we've contributed to this country, if that were the case, that enslaved Africans actually benefited from the skill sets of slavery, then why did we see such an explosion of the convict lease system after slavery had ended? Because we had so many people who were no longer employed after slavery had ended, with the creation of laws such as vagrancy for arresting enslaved free Africans who were now incarcerated because they could not find employment, gainful employment, which is one of the ways that we have the system of mass incarceration today, which started at the end of slavery. So to consider that Africans who were enslaved had absolutely no skill sets, that would be contradictory to even the building of the system of mass incarceration, which we see today.
Well, Gerald, why would there be this movement today of trying to redefine slavery? Why does there seem to be such, when we talk about the issue of Black Americans or African Americans, it is still such a divisive issue, even in 2023?
Well, that's true for a number of reasons. First of all, as has already been stated, the investment in the bodies of enslaved Africans was spectacular. The most valuable investment that there was in this country on the verge of the U.S. Civil War in 1860. Likewise, when slavery was abolished, what that meant was that slave owners, unlike in the British Caribbean, speaking of Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, and Tobago, in the United States, when slavery was abolished, unlike in the British Caribbean, the slave owners were not compensated. Now, let's not even talk about reparations to the descendants of the enslaved, which is also a live issue, and is also helping to shape this debate that we're now enmeshed in. But when slave owners were not compensated for the liquidation of their most valuable investment, that made them furious, that made them angry, that made them even more angry, since the investment, so-called, was then walking around saying that we were equal. And that creates this cyclone of anger and fury that percolates to this very day. And then that brings us back to the question of reparations for slavery, which is a major demand.
Well,
for
stay with me, because I want to get to reparations more towards the end of the program. We're going to definitely touch on that issue. Now, Joseph, when we often hear about Black Americans being dehumanized, arrested, or killed by police, even today, Why hasn't the U.S. been able to come to terms with this African-American minority community, even though many of them have been in that country longer than their European counterparts?
It's purely the result of structural racism. I mean, there's really no other way to explain it. One of the things that I would also like to expound upon, and just in terms of what it means to be violent, and we know that historically, from 1619 up until the present, that white Americans have been engaged in the most violence, not only in the United States, but internationally, which is the form of structural violence, which is meant to erase our history, is probably one of the most violent forms of perpetrating crimes against humanity in a group of people that require this discussion at the United Nations. And so when we're talking about the erasure of history, what does that mean? Well, clearly the erasure of history is meant to be violent. And for enslaved African Americans and for Africans who live in America today, that history still has not been acknowledged truthfully by many people. And we're at a point, an juncture in the history of our country where there are those who choose to perpetuate revisionist history. And I would consider Ron DeSantis to be one of those individuals. And for whom does it benefit? Well, they're clearly a block of young voters now who are beginning to shift away from the Republican Party. And I agree with Professor Horn that this is a desperate attempt to galvanize those individuals who actually, in terms of their economic condition in this country, are falling behind. And so for the DeSantis of the world who are speaking to people, policies are not benefiting them. The history of Black Americans and our achievements are not benefiting them. This is a call to all of those individuals who are on the conservative right, who believe they've been disenfranchised by the movements of other individuals in this country, that they feel like they need to be acknowledged. But as we know, that in many cases, those poor whites who have been excluded from the economic success and social mobility in this country have often been offered not economic bribes, but psychological and racial bribes with no economic incentive attached to them at all. And this is one of the ways to continue that ideology of allowing poor whites and working class whites to believe that they're a step above Black Americans by pushing these notions that slavery, for example, was a benefit to African Americans. And the next thing we'll hear is that prison and incarceration is a benefit to African Americans. And we know that those are empirically false.
Indeed. Well, back to Houston, Professor Horn. Very little attention is given to the fact that even today, millions of African Americans living don't really know their real identities, not really knowing their family histories, not knowing their real names or their roots. I mean, I believe it was writer James Baldwin who said, African Americans are Africans with no memories and Americans with no privilege. Your perspective on this, and little is talked about when one's identity is taken away and generational, this just accumulates, and the overall effect that it can have on one's psyche.
Well, certainly that is one side of the equation. But I would also like to remind your audience something that anthropologists have pointed out over the decades, which is that even though our names were taken, our knowledge of indigenous African languages were taken, our knowledge of African religions were taken, if not liquidated, but the fact is there are other survivals that survived the crossing of the Atlantic Ocean. I'm speaking of music, for example. I'm speaking of even the way we speak the English language and what we've added to the English language. But having said that, I think it is fair to say that those who are backing Governor DeSantis would prefer not to deal with these issues because, as noted, it conflicts with their romanticized idea about the history of the United States. And I might also say that your audience, and indeed the people around the world, have a stake in this conflict, because it's no secret that what the United States did to West Africa and East Africa during the bad old days of the African slave trade was a kind of violence already noted that has been exported worldwide, exported to Afghanistan, exported to Iraq, exported to Libya. And so what the United States did to what are now Black Americans is something that they have attempted to do worldwide. That is to say, loot and plunder for the benefit of a narrow minority.
Well, Joseph, you mentioned something before about basically this type of action tries to appease to the poor white that he is better than African Americans or Black Americans. I want to look at this. Do you think that part of this is sort of a tactic to divide the races and actually keep people from a certain unity, concentrating on the main element of the problem, and that would probably be the whole neoliberal system and capitalist system? I don't know. What's your assessment of that side of it?
I mean, historically, we've seen many movements where poor whites and Blacks and even indigenous populations have been aligned to challenge the government. And in the majority of those situations, those movements were crushed because poor whites, again, were offered racial and psychological bribes that did not benefit them economically. And so history has proven that, you know, Poor People's Campaign, we've seen very early on in many of the rebellions, Populist Party in this country very early on, where whites and Blacks were aligned, and then a racial bribe was made to benefit or intended to benefit white Americans to divide the races. But we also know that race is also a social construct. So the first division actually started with creating categories of race, which was meant to benefit a small minority of white Europeans at the expense of poor white populations, as well as enslaved Africans and indigenous populations. So The mere fact that we know that race is a social construct is where all of this, I believe, emanated.
Okay.
But ultimately, if you look at the data, and I would suggest and recommend that, highly recommend that your viewers follow the work of Black economist Sandy Darity, that we know that just in terms of the racial wealth gap in this country, that even a white American with no high school diploma actually has more wealth than a Black American with a college degree. And so in order to address these racial gaps, I don't believe that education will be the way out of it. It will have to be economic remediation and restoration for the descendants of enslaved Africans, and not just in the America, not just in North America, but globally.
Okay, well, you've touched on something that I want to look at. Professor Horn, the United States committed genocide against Black Americans, and why haven't we seen reparations for them despite the intergenerational repercussions on this community? I mean, how can Washington get away with this for so long?
Well, there's not sufficient global pressure. I'd like to remind you and your audience that the way in which the United States moved away from its own peculiar version of apartheid, speaking of the system known as Jim Crow, which in some ways was more pernicious than its cousin in apartheid South Africa pre-1994, was precisely because of international pressure. That is to say, during the Cold War, the United States was in an ideological contestation with the then Soviet Union. It was losing allies in a newly emergent and dependent Africa and the Caribbean. And so Washington felt that it had to ease somewhat the horrific nature of U.S. apartheid, U.S. Jim Crow, in order to fight the Cold War more effectively against the then Soviet Union. The Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. Since that time, there has been less international pressure on the United States of America to get rid of its horrific racism. And I would add one more point in terms of the stake that your audience has in this controversy. Just recently, the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated anti-racist measures known as affirmative action. However, they made an exception for the military. That is to say, the military can still pursue anti-racist measures internally in order to make sure that there are Black lieutenants and naval officers and Air Force pilots. And of course, that will be directed abroad. At the same time, when anti-racist measures to lift up the Black poor are invalidated, it seems to me if your audience understands what I've just said, they will understand also that this fight is also their fight.
Indeed. Well, Joseph, the road of Black Americans in the United States has always been filled with roadblocks and curves, from slavery to segregation, disenfranchisement, wealth inequality, discrimination, police violence, mass incarceration, and so much more. Do you see the future being different? And if so, what will it take to get there?
I think by the mere fact that we are still here as Black Americans, and despite all the forms of violence that have been presented to us, we have still managed to move and push ahead. I'm quite hopeful, and it may not happen, you know, during my lifetime, but I'm quite hopeful and positive about the changes that I see potentially on the forefront happening. But I agree with Professor Horn's analysis that this is much more of a global condition, and we definitely need to have much more of a pan-Africanist approach to how we're going to address these things. And when we see, for example, countries in Africa where there's been a push for the nationalization of resources and ultimately the U.S. government via the CIA or any other nefarious agency has attempted to neutralize leaders who have pushed internationally for economic independence from the strangle of Western imperialism, we've often seen those leaders killed, whether it's Patrice Lumumba or Muammar Gaddafi pushing for a united currency in Africa. And now we're seeing that with the BRICS.
Right. So, 10 seconds.
So I see that our primary goal is to wage our war on an economic front. And that will require those countries that have the wealth of resources to band together as a united front
On that note, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Gerald Horn, Professor of African American Studies, University of Houston, out of Houston, Texas. Joseph Richardson, Professor of African American Studies, University of Maryland, out of Laurel, Maryland. And thank you, viewers, for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. See you next time.